So yeah, I'll talk about cryptographic hash functions and the many ways that they are used. I want to thank Chanjit Jutla and Hugo Kravchik for helping me putting up these slides. So let's start from a high level. What are hash functions? The abstract is just a method for compressing strings, right? You got a function, it takes arbitrary long strings and it compresses it down to some fixed length, let's say 160 bits. Throughout this talk, I'm going to call the input to the hash function a message. I'm going to call the output a digest. And why you may want to compress strings? Well, basic principles. Short and fixed size is always better than long and variable size. That's true whether you do crypto or not. Some other reasons that are more geared towards crypto is you can add the digest to the message if you want to have redundancy, for example, for the purpose of authentication or detecting errors. Or you can have the digest stand in place of the actual message, and if you do that, then you can hope that the digest hides some structure that existed in the original message and things like that. So I want to jump ahead just a little bit and describe how typical hash functions, cryptographic hash functions, are built these days, because this particular structure would appear several times throughout the talk. And typically, the way we build hash functions is we build them from smaller components that are called compression functions. And a compression function is essentially just like a hash function, except that it doesn't accept arbitrary long messages. It accepts messages of some fixed length, and it compresses them down to some other fixed length, shorter than that. And you can think of them as having two inputs. One B-bit input, let's say 160-bit input, and the other one a block of 512 bits. And it takes these inputs, it compresses them down to one output of 160 bits. And then if you want to use this thing to build a hash function, then you just iterate it. You break your message into blocks, you start from some fixed initial value, and at each step you take one block of the message with the current value, it's called the chaining variable in this case, and you just compress it down and feed it as input to the next iteration. So that's the way we typically build hash functions these days. Not always. Towards the end of the talk, I'll actually talk about other ways of building hash functions as well. What are they good for? Well, they're good for many things. In particular, 2 years ago, NIST published a request for candidate algorithm nominations where they asked the public to suggest designs of hash function. And in that request, they specified a few applications that use hash functions, in particular digital signature algorithms, message authentication codes, pseudo-random number generations, and key derivation functions. And beyond these applications, there are actually many more. So here are a few examples of things that you can do with hash functions. Perhaps the most familiar one is signatures. So we want to sign a message M. What we typically do is use a hash function to hash it down and then apply the, roughly speaking, apply the RSA function to the digest. Another thing, you can use it for message authentication. You have a sender and a receiver. They share a key. And they compute an authentication tag, roughly speaking, by applying a hash function to the key and the message. And then they attach the tag to the message that can use to authenticate. Commitment, I want to commit to a message, but I don't want to reveal it just yet, so I'm going to hash the message together with some other stuff, perhaps. And I'm going to just send you the digest, and later on I can show you the message and the rest of the things, and you can verify that I really did the commitment correctly. Key derivation, we just did a Diffie-Hellman key exchange. Now we share some very long string, maybe 1,000 bits, maybe 4,000 bits, whatever. But what we really want is to do AES encryption with this. So we're going to hash down the Diffie-Hellman value with our hash function and get our AES key this way. And one other example that I want to talk about, because it really stresses the things that we need out of this hash function, is a very old method, actually, by Fiat and Shamir from over 20 years ago for removing interaction. And the way it works is you start from some interactive identification protocol. So you can think of A being a client and B being a server. The client wants to authenticate itself to the server, to show the server that this is really that client. And then they run some protocol. And these protocols, it's the particular way that they typically work. These are three-round protocols where A sends something to B. B comes up with a random challenge and sends it to A. And then A, based on the secret that it knows and the thing that it sends in the first flow and the challenge that B sent it, computes some response, sends it to B, and B checks it. So you start by that, with that, but now you want to make it non-interactive. So what you do is you just replace B with a hash function. So instead of the challenge being chosen randomly, you compute the challenge deterministically as a hash function of whatever was sent in the first flow and whatever other context information you have in that application. And now all of a sudden, A can compute everything by itself. It doesn't need B at all around it. It just comes up with the something, computes the challenge, and then compute the reply the way it was doing it before. And now it can just send this something together with the response, and everybody can verify it. Because everybody, at least everybody knowing what B is supposed to know in that application. And what you get, in fact, is a signature scheme. And if you look at it, you can trace DSS signatures to something that came out of starting from an identification thing and removing the interaction in this way. So if you look at this last example in particular, you need a lot from the hash functions. You're actually going to use this hash function here to replace something that was meant to be completely random. So I want to spend the first part of my talk talking about random functions versus hash functions. And the thing is, we really do want our hash functions to behave just like random functions. In all the applications that I specified before, this is what we really want the hash functions to do. And if it was a random function, then what we mean by that is that for every message, the digest associated with that message is just a random string chosen uniformly regardless of anything else. And if we have a function that behaves like that, then we get a lot of properties. The digest have no correlation to the original message that we were hashing. It's just random. If you have several distinct messages, M1, M2, et cetera, then the digests of these messages are uncorrelated with each other at all. Again, just random strings. You cannot find collisions or even near collisions to messages that hash to strings that are similar. You cannot find a message to hit a specific digest. You cannot find fixed point, which is D, such that if you hash it, you get back the same D, et cetera. Basically, what you want is this meat grinder. And it doesn't matter what you put in, it's always this uniform, structureless thing comes out at the other end. And this thing, saying that what we want from the function is to behave just like random, was formulated in 93 by Belar and Rogoway when they presented the random oracle paradigm. And this paradigm is actually a recipe for building cryptosystems. And the recipe goes like this. Pretend that you have a hash function that really does behave like a random function. Pretend that you really do have a random function. And then design a secure cryptosystem that uses that random function and prove security relative to a random oracle. Random oracle and a random function is the same thing. And the mental picture is that you have this Oracle of Delphi, and everybody in the world can access her, bad guys, good guys, this Lego guy, everybody can access this oracle. And the way the oracle answers questions is by tossing coins. So if you ask her the same question twice, you're going to get the same answer twice. But if you ask her a question that she didn't see before, then she's just going to toss coins and give you as answer the set of coin tosses that she came up with. So in this world where everybody has access to this random oracle, now you can design a cryptosystem that uses the random oracle. It can ask questions, get back the random answer, and then uses it in the computation somehow. And once you design this crypto system and prove that in the random oracle world, this crypto system is secure, now you're going to implement it. Well, we don't have random oracles in a real world, so you're gonna, just going to replace it with a hash function, a deterministic one that has a specific way of computing it. And then you hope that your crypto system remains secure after that. And this paradigm was suggested over 15 years ago, and it's actually been a huge success. There are tons and tons of crypto systems that were designed in the random oracle paradigm and proving secure in the random oracle model. For example, OAEP encryption, full domain hash and PSS signatures, and also all the examples from the previous slides that I described, all of them had examples of things that were designed and proven secure in the random oracle model. And the thing that makes it so successful is all of these schemes seem to withstand the test of time. So OAEP was designed, I think, in the mid-90s and still is considered secure, other than minor tweaks. But for the most part, it's considered secure. Almost every other crypto system that was ever designed used in the random oracle model seems to behave similarly. We don't see major breaks in them. So it definitely is a very valuable method of designing crypto system, but I want to spend a few slides talking about the rationale for this paradigm. And the rationale is more or less the following. Suppose I design some crypto system, call it S, let's say it's a signature scheme, and that crypto system uses a hash function H. And I prove that S is secure when H is a random function. What does that mean? Now I'm going to implement this hash function the crypto system using the hash function, and later on down the road somebody came up with an attack on it. Well, that has to mean that the attack must use some non-random property of H. I proved that if H was random, then no attack is possible. So any attack should exploit some non-random property of H. So does that mean that I did a bad job in designing S? No, it just means that I did a bad job choosing my H. So I should have chosen a better H that doesn't have this whatever non-random property was used in the attack. Of course, as a practitioner, this is sort of an unsatisfying answer because, okay, so this H wasn't good. Can you tell me what non-random properties I should be looking out for? And a random oracle analysis doesn't actually tell you that, but at least it tells us that the scheme S, regardless of how I implement H, that scheme doesn't have structural flaws. Except it doesn't really. In fact, from mathematical speaking, this rationale is really not sound because I can build, let's say, a signature scheme that A, I can prove secure with respect to random functions, and B, I can easily break no matter how you implement this function later on. And the observation is, well, at some point during the life of this thing, when I come to implement the system, the hash function has to be computable. And being computable in and of itself is a non-random property. So let's build ourselves a scheme that is secured only for functions that are not computable. The scheme is very contrived. I'm going to describe it. It's actually very easy. So you start from any secure signature scheme. And let's denote the signature algorithm by sig1. So sig1 is a signature algorithm of some signature scheme. It takes as input the key, the secret key. It takes as input the message. It has access to this hash function that we're using. And it generates a signature somehow. And let's say that we know that this signature scheme that we started from was secure indeed. So now I'm going to make a destructive modification to this signature scheme. I'm going to design a sig2, and the way sig2 is going to work, it takes its message. First thing that it does is it tries to see if the message itself is a code of something. Let's say it's tried to interpret it as JavaScript code. And now it has the hash function that it uses. It has this code that it just got as input, and it checks whether the code and the hash function compute the same thing. So it runs the hash functions on 1, 2, 3, and it runs the code on 1, 2, 3, and it checks it if it gets the same answer. And if that happens to be the case, then what it does is something stupid like outputting the secret key as the signature. And otherwise, it reverts back to the good SIG1 algorithm. So why did I do all of that? Notice that if H is random, then no code implements it. So the first test would always fail. We will always be in the else case, and things are good. This scheme is completely secure, just as the original one was when implemented with a random function. On the other hand, if you implement it with any function that can actually be computed, then if you try to sign the code of that function that you're using, you're going to get the secret key out. So it's completely breakable in that way. Okay, that's a very contrived example, and what exactly does it tell us? The way I look at it is it's a cautionary note. Random Oracle proofs may not mean exactly what you think they do. I don't want to come off saying that random Oracle proofs are meaningless. They're actually very meaningful. They give a very strong assurance of security in the sense that they rule out a very wide class of attacks. And in many practical settings, the class of attacks that they rule out basically cover everything that you would think of as a cryptanalyst. So they give you very valuable assurance. They just don't actually give you a formal proof, really. The other problem with random Oracle proofs, or random Oracle analysis in general, it doesn't tell you what non-random properties you need to look up for. So if I'm looking at OAAP and I'm asking myself, what is the thing that the hash function should have for OAAP to be secure? We don't really know. And the random Oracle analysis that we have doesn't tell us. How would these schemes be affected by weakness in the hash function? So somebody found some weakness of the hash function. Does that affect OAP or doesn't it? Again, the random Oracle analysis doesn't tell us. And the other point that I want to make about random Oracle designs is that it could lead to careless implementation, because when you design your crypto system, you're thinking that you have this perfect hash function. So you may do things that, well, if the hash function was really that perfect, it would be okay. But in real life, it's not that perfect. And you could have put a little more effort into it and designed it slightly better so that it would resist imperfections. And you didn't because you thought your hash function was so perfect. And I will have several examples throughout the talk of that point. And one last thing to say about hash functions versus random functions is the way I described that hash functions are inherently don't behave like random things because they are built with some structure, in particular the Merkle-Damgaard construction. So even if we think that our compression functions are perfect and they're really implemented in a good way and they behave just like random functions, our hash functions are not that perfect. For example, if you use the hash function with a secret key, and what you do is you just concatenate the secret key and the message and then hash it, then if I know the hash of a message M with that key and I want to compute the hash of a message M concatenated N prime with that secret key, I no longer need to know the key. This is a very non-random property, but if you use Merkle-Damgaard, this is just what happens. So you have these extension attacks. There are minor changes to Merkle-Damgaard that would fix it, but they're not free. For example, you're going to have to do perfect free encoding or to use something like HMAC or something of that sort. Moreover, the compression functions are not all that perfect either. They are typically built from lower-level components, so they're typically built from something that looks like a block cipher using transformation, the Davis-Meier transformation. And this provides yet more structure, and there are examples where, because of that structure, things that are provably secure in the random Oracle model turns out to be broken when you look at the actual implementation. So with that, let me talk a little bit about how do we use hash functions in application, or should I say, how should we use hash functions in application? We know that they're not perfect. We know that they're not completely random. How are we going to go about designing application that uses these imperfect hash functions? And the thing that I want to put out, stress here is that applications should rely on specific security properties of hash functions and try to make these properties as standard and as weak as possible. This is sort of common sense. It increases the odds of long-term security. When later on somebody discovers weakness in the hash function, the application is more likely to survive if the thing that it assumed on the hash function is as weak as possible. And maybe the prime example is MD5 and HMAC MD5. So MD5 is really badly broken these days. Nobody should use MD5 for anything. But if you already have HMAC MD5 in your product, you're not too bad. You should phase it out, but you shouldn't issue an emergency patch. So I would like to break the security requirements that we typically have of hash functions into four broad categories, depending on how these hash functions are used in applications. The strongest type of requirements that we have correspond to deterministic hash. This is when the adversary gets to influence the things that we hash. So let's just think that the adversary chooses the message. And then we hash that message plain vanilla with no additions, and we're going to use this digest somehow in the application. These type of things are, when we think of what the security requirements are, these are the strongest ones. Then there is hashing with a random public salt, where, again, the attacker can influence the messages that we sign, but then the good guy chooses some public salt and hash the salt together with the message. And you don't try to hide the salt in any way, but the adversary cannot influence it. Then there's hashing random messages. You just have a random message, let's say a Diffie-Hellman value, if you would, and you hash that. And the typically weakest requirement is when you use the hash function with the secret key. This is very similar to the salt, only in this case, the key that you use is never revealed to the adversary. So the adversary can see M, it can influence M, it can even choose M, and it can see the digest, but it can never see the key. Let me go over the particular requirements that arise in each of these use cases. So for the deterministic hashing, the prime example is collision resistant. We ask that the attacker will not be able to find M and M prime that hash to the same thing. But there are many other properties, and some of them are used in various places. It is hard to find fixed point. It is hard to find near collisions. It is hard to find messages such that the digest of that message has a low Hamming weight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are actually many of those. Hashing with public salt, the prime example is target collision resistant. The scenario here is the attacker chooses M, then the attacker is given the random salt after it already chose M, and then it cannot find M prime that hashes to the same thing under that particular salt. And there is a slightly stronger notion where the attacker, again, chooses M, gets a salt, and then it cannot find collision, but now it's able to come up with a different salt. The important thing in both of these things is that the attacker has to commit to the first message before it sees the random salt. So that's the thing that makes the attacker's life hard in this scenario. Hashing random message, there is the notion of second pre-image resistant. When you're given a random message M, you cannot find M prime that hashes to the same thing. And there are other properties like one-wayness or extraction. The point I want to make about extraction is that it's a combinatorial property. It's not a cryptographic one in that when you describe what you really want of the hash function, there is no adversary in this description. And that means that we can actually build systems where we can prove that they have, build hash function where we can prove that they have this extraction property. And then hashing with secret key, the prime example would be a pseudorandom function. The attacker doesn't know the key, but it has access to this mapping from M to H of key and M. So it can choose M, it can see the digest. But even so, this mapping looks random to an attacker. And then there's universal hashing, which is another combinatorial property that's very related, actually, to extractions, to extraction. So let me describe some applications and show how the different requirements express themselves when you look at a particular application, and I want to start with digital signatures. So here is how we sign messages today. We use the hash then sign paradigm, which means that we first apply the hash function to the message, get a digest, and then we use whatever signature algorithm that we have, so it's RSA or DSS or what have you, apply that to the digest. And it's obvious that if you're going to use your hash function in this way, then the security of your signature depends on collision resistance. Because if the adversary was able to find M and M prime that hash to the same thing, and then you signed M, you gave the adversary also a signature of M prime without knowing it. And because this is the way we sign today, then the attacks on MD5 and SHA-1 really threaten current signatures. And actually so much so that next week in crypto, there's going to be a paper showing that you can use the attacks on MD5 to get bad CA certificates. And this is kind of bad. I mean, we really want to trust our CAs, and we don't want to have for them to be able to get bad certificates. And relying on collision resistance is a problem because getting collision resistant, designing a hash function that will be collision resistant is really, really hard. Why is it really hard? Well, the attacker works offline, first thing. It can use whatever cryptanalysis is available at the time. It can use as much computation power as it can gather, and it can do that without being detected because the attacker is doing this attack offline. It helped by the birthday attack, so if you have a digest size of 160 bits, then even if you only do a brute force, you only need to do 2 to the 80 work as opposed to 2 to the 160. And it's well worth the effort because once you find the collision, then I have forgery for every signer. So if I find the collision and then I ask Dan to sign M for me, then I have Dan's signature on M prime. And if I want to, and then if I ask somebody else to sign M for me, then I have that somebody else signature on M prime. So it's actually one collision, get many forgeries for free. And the other thing about relying on collision resistant is that at least in principle, we know that it's not necessary. For over 20 years now, we know that we don't need to rely on collision resistance to do secure signatures. This started from work of Naor and Jung in 89, and the thing to do is to use randomized hashing. The way it would work is the following. If you want to sign a message M, what you as the signer do is choose some fresh random salt and then hash the salt together with the message and then sign both the salt and the digest together. So let's see what that does for the attack scenario, the collision attack scenario. Now the attacker can still choose the message to be signed, but it cannot start looking for collisions until it knows what the salt is. So only after the signer chooses the salt, the attacker can start looking for M prime. And notice that it has to be the same salt. The attacker needs to find collision with respect to the same salt. Because the salt is included under the signature. And the important thing about this attack, it's inherently online. The attacker has to interact with the good signer in order to mount this attack. And that makes a huge difference. And preventing this attack clearly relies on the hash function being target collision resistant. Now let's talk about how to implement target collision resistant hashing. And I want to point out that not every randomization procedure that you'd think of would work in this case. In particular, something like appending the salt to the message does not work. If your hash function is Merkle-Damgård and you find a collision, offline collision with respect to M, then you find on-fly collision with respect to M concatenate with salt. So not everything that you do would work. And oddly enough, the randomization procedure that prescribed in PSS is exactly that. Why? Because PSS was proven in the random oracle model, and the people working on that particular standard had random oracle in mind, and random oracles don't have this property, so they didn't take care to kill that particular attack. This is part of my point about thinking in the random oracle does give you a good intuition, but then you have to be careful when you come down to implementing it. Nonetheless, we do know how to implement target collision resistance. Well, we have many implementations that we can prove actually work in the sense that they give you a target collision resistant hash function. In principle, you can actually implement it from one-way functions, one-way functions being the weakest thing that we cryptographers use to do anything. So that those are sufficient to do target collision resistant hashing. But when you come to actually suggest an implementation to be used in the real world, there are still challenges. For example, most of the constructions that we have for target collision resistant hashings use long salt, even salt that is not a fixed size. The salt size has to depend, at least logarithmically, on the length of the message that you're trying to hash. Also, the constructions that we have don't preserve Merkle Damgard. So you cannot just take a Merkle Damgard hashing and then slap some randomization around it. You have to go into the mechanics of Merkle Damgard and change some things in the chaining variables as it go from one block message block to the next. So this is on the level of implementing the target collision resistant hashing. On the level of using it in signatures, if you are going to sign not only the digest but also the salt, then you need to change your signature scheme to do that. In particular, if you have a standard, you need to change your standard so that now you include also the salt under the signature. And we all know how fun it is to change existing standards. So let's try to do better. Let's try to come up with a construction that really only does randomization without touching other layers of the implementation. And to do that, this is work that I did with Hugo Kravchik a couple of years ago. We need to make slightly stronger assumption on our hash function in order to get some engineering type of advantages. So we use this notion of enhanced target collision resistant. And then what we do is the same thing as we did before. To sign an M, first you choose some fresh random salt. You hash the salt together with the message. But now you're only going to sign the digest, not the digest and the salt. And going to the attack scenario is the same, except now the attacker is free to change the salt. So if it wants to find collision, it's okay from the attacker's perspective if the collision is not with respect to the same value of the salt. But the important point that remains that the attack is still inherently online. You cannot start looking for collisions, at least in principle, before you actually saw the salt that the signer was using. And how are you going to implement this enhanced target collision resistance? So we suggested a very simple message randomization where you take your message, you have one block of randomness, and what you do is you just take this block of randomness and then, in addition to that, XOR it into all the message blocks. So you started from an L block message and you have a randomized version, which is L plus one bits. And we actually proved that hash after this randomization is enhanced target collision resistant if the hash is Merkle-Damgard and the compression function has some property which is similar to being a second per-image resistant. It's not quite that, but it's not far either. And then your signature is just you do you sign the digest the way you did before, and you have to also send your randomness because you need the randomness in order to verify the signature. You choose a fresh randomness per signature. It's exactly one block, for example, 512 bits. You don't change the hash. You don't need to sign the randomness. So just pictorially, what we started from is just a plain hash and sign where you apply the hash to your message and then sign it. And what we end up with is just a layer of randomization that doesn't do anything to our signature except randomizing the message that we randomize the message before we sign it. And just to stress again, if we were using a target collision resistant, then we needed to go inside this red box and sign also the randomness. But because we're using this slightly stronger notion of enhanced target collision resistant, then we don't need to do that anymore. So that was one example. How much time do I have? Okay, I'm good. Let me go quickly over one other example of how to take advantage of your hash function and how to assume things, how to assume weak properties of your hash functions and use it in an application. So look, let's look at message authentication. In that application, the sender and the receiver share a secret key, and they want to compute an authentication tag, and then the sender sends it, and the receiver verifies it, with the property that the attacker cannot forge tags. And the typical way it's done today is with HMAC. This is a construction due to Belair, Canetti, and Kravchik. They observe that simple things like key prepend and key append have problems when they are used with Merkle-Damgård hash functions. If you prepend the key, then you're subject to extension attack. If you append the key, then you rely on collision resistance of the hash function. I actually talked about both of these points already. So what they suggested is this HMAC construction where you first hash the key with the message and then hash the key again with the digest that you got in the first place. It's about as fast as the key prepend construction when you use a Merkle-Damgård hash function, and it relies only on the property of the compression function being a pseudorandom function when the key is secret. And the reason that HMAC stood so well in face of attacks on MD5 and SHA-1 is exactly that. It's explicitly designed to rely on things, on weak properties of the hash function, and therefore when the hash function turns out to be imperfect or even badly broken, that particular weak property of it is likely to be still maintained, and therefore HMAC is likely to still be secure. But you can actually do other things if all you want is authentication. And a line of work that started with Wegman and Carter in the early 80s have the following recipe for coming up with authentication code. So you compress your message with a hash, you get some temporary value t, and then you hide t using some other pseudorandom function. You just XOR this temporary value to some pseudorandom, something that you computed from a pseudorandom function. And the pseudorandom function can be many things. It can be AES, it could be HMAC, it could be RC4 maybe. But the point is that you only apply it to a short nonce, not to your message. So if the message is long enough, that thing will not be your performance bottleneck. And you can prove that this thing is secure if your pseudorandom function is good and if your hash function is universal, which is this combinatorial property that I had a couple of slides back. The specific combinatorial property that you need here is that for any two different messages and a fixed delta, if you fix these two messages and that delta and then choose your key at random, then the probability that this difference between the digest be exactly that delta is bounded by some small enough epsilon. Again, this is not a cryptographic construction. There is no adversary in this description, and it can be very fast. The reason that it can be very fast is when we design crypto, we need security margin. We want to protect against some attacker, and we don't know what this attacker is going to do, so we're going to over-engineer our things to protect us against anything that we think the attacker might be able to do. Here we know exactly what the attack scenario, so we can design our systems to be much faster. And there are actually a lot of works on fast implementation of universal hashing. There are a construction based on an inner product. So an example would be that one, which takes two-block messages and uses two-block keys. It just add it and do one multiplication. There's a lot of work on polynomial evaluation. Now you only have one block of key and many blocks of message, and we just use it as a polynomial. You compute sigma I mi times k to the power I. This is how you use your hash key. And these works, if you really work on it, you can get it down to be as fast as maybe two or three cycles per byte for long m's on the average. in software implementation on contemporary CPUs. So this is about one order of magnitude faster than any crypto that we know how to build today, roughly speaking. So again, this is a different type of example of the advantages that you can get when you only use weak property of your hash function. In this case, the advantage would be speed. So if you have an implementation that really needs speeds in software, then that might be the way to go. So with that, just get a drink of water. Let me talk a little bit about how you build these hash functions. So far, I told you many things about hash functions, how they should be used, how they maybe should not be used, but I didn't say anything about how we actually go about designing one of those. So I want to go just give you some glimpse of how do you design a hash function in the hope that it will be secure and have all these wonderful properties that I talked about. And as an example, I'm going to use Fugue, which is IBM's candidate for the NIST hash competition. And maybe the first thing you need to decide when you want to go ahead and design a hash function is whether or not the thing that you really want to do is design a compression function. And the pros is, well, compression function is a modular design. You start from maybe an easier task of designing a compression function. That might be simpler than designing a full-blown function. And we know many things about the transformation from compression to hash. The con of that is that that transformation is, typically it does have some problems. So for one thing, it's not free. You need message encoding or HMAC or something like that to protect against various problems. The other thing is that there are some attacks that are involved, in particular the message extension attack that I described, and also some birthday type attacks, attacks that take advantage of the particular structure and the birthday paradox. And I actually want to describe one of them because I think it's really cute. So let me describe the herding attack, D2, Kelsey, and Kono. I'm not going to say what the attack does until I get to the end of the slide. I'm just going to describe how it works and then say why the attacker may want to do that. So what you do is you start by looking for offline collisions in your underlying compression functions. And actually, not only one collision, but many of them. And you find so many collisions that you actually can put it in a tree. So for values D11 and D12, when these are your chaining variables, you find two message blocks that make these values collide and call that output D21, and then you find the collision for D21 and D22. Basically, what you do is you find many, many collisions and then arrange them in a tree, and they showed how you can actually make a tree with roughly 2 to the n over 3 DIJs using time roughly 2 to the 2n over 3. So that might be a long time, but it's certainly less than 2 to the n. And then you have your final digest value at the root of that tree, and you publish it for everybody to see. And the thing that this thing lets you do is later on somebody comes and gives you some prefix p. Then you just do some exhaustive search to find a message block L such that the hash of P and L happens to be one of these digest values that you have in the tree. And once you find that L, this link thing, now you can read off the tree. Suppose that this L landed you here, then you can read off the tree whatever it is that you need in order to get to the root. So then after you publish D, somebody gives you P, and you're able to come up with L and S such that the hash of PLS is this original D that you published. So I published it, and I said that this is the result of all the matches in next year's football season. And then when next year's come, and now I know what the results are in the football season, then I'm just going to find some ways to map these actual results to the thing that I published ahead of time. And here I just proved to you that I knew how this, all the results of next year's football season. And the point about the time is it only takes 2 to the 2n over 3 time to do that, as opposed to 2 to the n, which is the thing you would think that it should take you for a hash function with n bit output. Why? So the issue here is that Merkel-Damgaard has this problem that it keeps small intermediate states. With the compression functions, what we do essentially is take in the current message block, work, throw out all this work, keep only an n bit state, and then feed this state into the next message block. And so you might think that the alternative would be to keep a larger intermediate state. And indeed, there is a way of building hash functions this way. The way you would do it typically is you keep a large state, you take the current block or word of your message, work hard, update some of this big state, and then move on. It's a more flexible approach. So on one hand, it might lead to some advantages. On the other hand, it gives you a lot more opportunities to mess things up if you don't really know what you're doing. So this last part of the talk is a little more technical than the previous ones. I want to actually describe sort of hash functions and the inner workings of them to some extent. And let me start with Grindle. Grindle is a relatively new hash function, was designed by Knudsen, Eschberger, and Thompson 2 years ago. It has a relatively big internal state, 50-something bytes. And it processes one word at a time. And it does some AES type of mixing per input word of input. So it takes this word of input, it put it inside the state, just overriding whatever was in that part of the state before, and then it does some things, some mixing on the column, which is very much like AES, and it shifts the rows, and it keeps doing that. And at the end of this whole thing, when all the input was read, then it does some more of these mixing stuff, and at the end it output 8 words. So it's actually a very nice hash function, but it's not as secure as intended. So Perrin was actually, soon after it was published, show that you can have an attack with complexity roughly 2 to the 112. This is in no way a practical attack, but it's certainly better than brute force attack on that hash function. It actually improved somewhat to about 2 to the 100 recently. And the way this attack works, I'm not going to show details at all, but the way this attack works conceptually is you start from a collision, and then you go backwards and see what kind of constraints need to happen for a collision to take place. So when we designed Fugue, we actually took Grindle as our starting point and tried to come up with a hash function that works similar ways, but we use what we call the proof-driven design. Specifically, we designed the internal components of the hash function specifically so that we will be able to prove properties. And in particular, we're able to prove that attacks, just like the Perrin attack, or this style of attacks at all, cannot be applied to Fugue. The state of Fugue is much bigger than that of Grindle. It has 120 bytes. And it used 2 super mixing rounds per word of input. But it only applies that to a very small part of the state. And then some extra linear diffusion. So there's, in addition to these mixing stuff, there's some XORs that are going on back and forth. The super mixing is very much like AES, except it uses stronger codes. AES uses some things that can be looked at as error correcting code, and Fugue's loop uses similar things, except with stronger codes. Let me just describe it at a high level first. So the overall is what I said before. You start from initial state, there's 30 words. You feed in one message, you do some processing, you get a new state. You feed in the next message word, you do some processing, you get a new state. You keep iterating this until you get to a final state after all the message words have been read, and then you do final processing And at the end, you output 8 words of your original of the 30 in your state. And let's think about what a collision attack would mean here. So let's, for simplicity, think of collision between two messages of the same length. And let's delta mi be the difference between the ith message block in the two messages. So collision means that you have all this a bunch of deltas, not all of them are zero, because you want two different messages, and the delta in the output is zero. So this is one way of describing a collision, and there are actually two types of them. You can either have a collision on the entire state at the end of the input, so you can have delta state equals zero at that point, or not. If it is zero, then it's called an internal collision, and if the delta state is not zero, but still the output is the same, then it's called an external collision. And I'll show you how let me go a little deeper into the workings of fugue and describe how it works. So here's how you process one input word. You take the input word and you just put it in the state, overwriting whatever was written in the state before. Then you shift the entire state 3 columns to the right. You XOR some stuff into the first 3 columns. And then you do some supermix operation on the first 4 columns. The supermix operation is where the crypto happens. Everything else is just XORs here and there. And you repeat that thing once more, and only then you feed in the next message word. And the supermix operation is the thing that supposedly should make fugue strong cryptographically, and the way that works is somewhat similar to AES in that it works on a 4x4 matrix of bytes. It starts with S-box substitution, and S-box substitution is a very simple thing. We just have a fixed table in the implementation. It's actually the same table as used for AES. And you take each one of these 16 bytes and replace each byte B with S of B. And once you do this S-box substitution, you do some linear type of mixing. On the diagonal bytes, we do the same type of mixing that's done in AES, which means we take the value after the S-box substitution and we compute some linear multiples of it and put it in these linear multiples in the column. And for the other bytes, we do a little more sophisticated mixing where we take that value and put multiples of it in both the column and the row of that byte. And we repeat that type of processing for each one of the 16 bytes. Algebraically, you can think about it as take the 16 bytes, pass each one of them through an S-box substitution, then multiply it by some big 16 by 16 matrix. And the point about this matrix is it makes a very good linear code. So we can prove about that linear code statements of the form. For example, if you have BIs that are not all zero, but most of them are zero, at least 12 of them are zero, but not all, then it has to be the case that at most it has to be the case that at least 13 of the SBIs must be non-zero. So you cannot have too many zeros here and at the same time too many zeros here. If there are very few zeros here, there must be a lot of zeros here. That's the if you look at the two of them together as a code word with this thing being the information bytes and this thing being the parity check bytes, then this linear code has a very large minimum distance. And we can prove other such properties, but this property of the 4 and 13 is the one that I'm going to use in the rest of the exposition here. Yeah. No, the B is concatenate of the S. Take this thing as the information world. You multiply it by a matrix to get the parity check. So now let's look at how a collision would happen. And I'm going to actually walk you through this approach of starting from a collision and going backwards to see what happens. So the only thing in this entire processing which is not a permutation is the adversary feeding us a message world and stepping over something that was already in the state. So if a collision is to happen, it has to happen at the time where the adversary actually gave us a word. So let's look at the last word that the adversary gave us when a collision happened. So we know that before that, sorry, after the adversary gave us this last word, between the two messages that collided, after that, the state was the same. This is the meaning of internal collision. The adversary was able to give us two messages that ended up with the same internal state. What happened just before the adversary gave us this message? Well, the only thing in the state that the adversary touched in this step was this last column. This is where the adversary put the word. And before the adversary put the word, it has to be different. I mean, we said that this is the point where the collision happened, so collision didn't happen here, so the state must have been different here, and the only place where it could have been different is this one column. But notice now that among these four columns, only one of them is non-zero, which means that we have at most four non-zero byte differences. The previous thing that happened in the construction is we had this S-mix, and we already said that the S-mix has this coding property that if only four or less of the output are zeros, then at least 13 of the input bytes have to be zero. Well, at least 13, it means that at most three can be zero, which means that each one of these four words had to have at least one non-zero byte. So each one of these words is actually different between the two messages. Remember, we always thinking about the adversary having two messages and looking only at the differences in the messages and in the states between the processing of these two messages. Okay, let's keep going backwards. The thing that happened before is an XOR. That doesn't change differences at all. The thing that happened before is a shift of the column. So before the shift, we had this difference pattern. But now, again, we have just one word here that is different and three that are the same. So again, at most four non-zero byte differences. And the thing that happened before that was an S-mix. So again, the same argument. Before that S-mix, many of these words have to be different. XOR doesn't change. Shift of columns. And this is the previous time where the adversary could have fed something in. So now we have a word in the state that, depending on what the adversary did, may or may not have a zero difference. And all of these words must have non-zero differences, and all of those words must have zero differences. So we actually exactly know, up to this one word in the state, we exactly know how a collision pattern must look like. If you ended up with a collision, then at the time that you fed the previous input word, the two states must have looked like that. So this was just one message, but you can actually carry this analysis farther, and in the paper we actually have, we carried it quite a bit farther. The analysis that I showed was up to here. And one thing to notice that it's important for the claims of security is that before the S-mixes, we have many, many non-zero byte differences in our state. You can carry this even farther, up to four message words. What does all of this mean? So I established some pattern. I show you that if you want to have an internal collision, then the differences in the state have to evolve in some particular way. Why do we care? The reason we care is that consider the following attack. The attacker feeds in just random message word, M1, M2, M3, and M1 prime, M2 prime, M3 prime, and keeps doing that until the differences between the state happen to be good for the adversary. It's some particular difference that the adversary think could be useful for an attack. Once that happens, the attacker searches for some suffix of these things that would actually induce a collision. And what we were able to prove formally, well, there is some very mild independence assumption, is that for any fixed differences, once you're feeding these two things, now you have two states that have some fixed difference, the probability that there exists any suffix that would give you a collision is bounded by this number, 2 to the minus 150. Why do we care about this type of particular theorem? Well, for one thing, the pairings attacks are all of this form. So we prove that pairing-style attack will not work against fugue. But on slightly higher level, every differential attack can be seen as optimization of this type of attack, in that a differential attack always have the bytes that the attacker care about and the bytes that the attacker doesn't care about. And the ones that the attacker doesn't care about are always thought of as being just random bytes. And then when they come to interact with bytes that the attack does care about, then you pay some number in probability for the probability that they actually behave the way the attacker wants them to. So in that sense, every differential attack is actually an instance of this attack that I showed you with various optimizations. And on an even higher level, a known collision trace is as close as we can get to say that we actually understand the collision resistance of a hash function. If you have that, then at least you know what should happen for a collision to happen, for a collision to occur. If you don't even have a collision trace, then basically you don't know anything about what this, how this hash function does or doesn't resist collisions. So just a few concluding words about fugue. We also have similar analysis for external collision, and it's sort of an unusually thorough level of analysis for a contemporary hash function. The performance of fugue are roughly comparable to those of SHA-256. It's a little more amenable to parallelism because you process these 16 bytes independently. So if you have a lot of hardware, you can put 16 times the hardware, and then you can do all of those in parallel. It was one of the 14 submissions that were selected by NIST to advance to the second round of the SHA-3 competition. So NIST actually, after publishing this request, got 60-something submissions, of which 51 were deemed to satisfy the criteria that was set in the call for candidates. So they have 51 candidates, and just 2 weeks ago, they chose 14 of them to advance to the next level of competition. This hash function I described was one of them. So let me conclude the talk. So the morals of these things are hash functions are very useful. We use them all over the place in crypto. Every application that we have in crypto uses hash functions in this way or the other. We really would like them to behave just like random functions, but they don't really. They have some structure in it, and this structure sometimes can be exploited. When you design an application that uses hash function, the way to design it is to rely on as weak as practical properties of hashing. So if you need to make the requirements slightly stronger so to get a lot of engineering benefits, that might be worth the effort as long as you don't rely on things that are really too strong. And that trade-off is an art more than it is science, just as far as I can tell. So the TCR and enhanced TCR is an example of that. If you do TCR, you need to open some things that you would like to look at as black boxes, and if you rely on enhanced TCR, then you don't. And I show the taste of how a hash function is built and what type of analysis we know how to do for these hash functions. And that's that. Thank you.
So in your ETCR construction of signatures, you had the random lock R that you send along with the signature, which is of size 512 bits. What happens if you just send like a shorter thing and then you use a PRG of some sort to expand it to 512 bits?
Yeah, so the short answer is nothing much. The slightly longer answer is that it's a question of what exactly do you feel comfortable assuming on your underlying compression function. The property that you need to assume if you use a long randomness is very similar to secondary image resistance. The property that you need to assume if you use a shorter hash and maybe just concatenate it several times is slightly less similar to secondary image resistance. It means that it's hard to find collisions on messages that look like a concatenation of a random thing instead of a really random thing. So if you're comfortable assuming that on your compression function, then that
but
should work.
Not just concatenating, but you can take the short things, put it into any PRG, like RC4 or something, and make it 512 bits.
Yeah,
and then there's no
that
structure.
Would work as well, yeah. But I don't think you can argue much more, because the fact that it's a PRG doesn't mean much if at the end of the day the attacker actually knows what the seed to the PRG was.
That's right. Okay.
So you talked about the collision resistance properties of fugue, but what about other properties like the fixed point, low Hamming weight, extraction?
So some of them you can apply similar analysis. Actually, Charanjit says that he has an analysis showing something similar to universal hashing. I didn't see that analysis yet, so I don't know. But some of them, for example, secondary image resistance, you can apply very similar analysis. Pseudo-randomness, you can wave your hands and say that some things should behave similarly.
Mm-hmm. And for fixed points, for example, how would you even do an analysis?
We didn't look at it. I don't know.
Cool. Any other questions?
Great. Thanks, Alan.